Buddhism for Beginners, a podcast on foundational Buddhist teachings and techniques to use in your everyday life. This podcast is a production of Kunzang Payul Choling, a Buddhist center in the Payul lineage of the Nyingma School of Tibetan Buddhism. For more teachings, meditations, and resources, you can visit our online virtual temple at tara.org. That's T-A-R-A.org. We are taught to never truly surrender our heart, to never risk in order to experience great passion, to always keep something aside for ourselves. Our quest for safety leads us to compartmentalize our experiences and keep everything in a neat, controlled place. Jetsuma calls us to give rise to the phenomenal flame of compassion as the only thing that will truly keep us safe. If our feeling of safety comes from having control over our experiences, we are the least safe of all.
Today, I would like to talk a little bit about the kind of training that we receive and the way that our thinking develops in our culture and in our society, and to examine for ourselves whether it is counterproductive or useful in our quest to practice Dharma or in our quest to deepen spiritually. The basis of this thought, or this subject that I would like to talk about, comes from our recent pilgrimage to India. In our recent pilgrimage to India, one of the places that we visited was Sopema, which is a lake that mystically appeared when Guru Rinpoche was burned. The father of Mandarava, Princess Mandarava, because Guru Rinpoche and Mandarava were caught practicing together. Practicing together, my goodness. It's not like they went on a date or anything. Sorry, I had a little personal issue there. little energy happening. Anyway, they were caught practicing, and the king, who wanted Mandarava to marry a prince and so secure the growth of the kingdom, then decided to punish them, and he burnt Guru Rinpoche at the stake. And usually that on a big one of those fires piled up with wood. And usually when that happens, the burning would go for a day, possibly two, three at the outside, because, you know, according to the amount of wood that is used. But in this case, the burning went on for a long time, over a week. And the king went back and checked and found that instead of there being, he could see smoke coming, but instead of there actually being a fire there, what had happened was a lake had magically appeared and Guru Rinpoche was practicing with consort in the middle of that lake. So that is the lake that I went to visit. And right near that lake, there is also an amazing place that I found myself very drawn to, which is a very small cave that you have to bend down to go into, and that was Mandarava's cave. That was where she practiced, and she did practice extensively there. So in this cave, there is one lama who stays there and is constantly in retreat and has been for a long time. And so when I went there to visit, one of the things that I found was that the preciousness or the purity or the energy, the spiritual, I don't know, spiritual support of that cave had been kept up very perfectly, very preciously. There was a beautiful altar, a very simple altar, but a beautiful altar that was put there. There was a wonderful, the lama was constantly practicing. The cave was kept very clean, and quite frankly, not many of the pilgrimage places that are still there in India are kept very clean. That's not the style. Everything is very different there. There's different values in certain ways. So anyway, I went to this cave and I went in there. And when I went in there, I was deeply moved because when I was allowed to sit in the cave by myself for a while, the Lama was willing to let me go in there and be by myself. And at that point, I was able to really feel the blessing of Mandarava. I felt a very strong connection with her. I felt something of her mind. The feeling that I had was somewhat like two streams that came together to form one river. And I could feel that juncture and feel the connection with her. And so I had a really blessed and very delightful time in that cave. And then when I came out of the cave, I was told that this cave had another very important feature, and I thought this was pretty amazing. At the mouth of the cave, there's this one point where, according to the legend, according to the story, the king came to fetch Mandarava and to tear her away from Guru Rinpoche and bring her back to the castle, to where he stayed. And Mandarava was so distraught and would not be separated from her guru. She was so filled with devotion and so agonized by the thought of being separated from her guru that she actually grabbed onto the side of the cave. And the side of the cave, her, due to the force of her devotion, there's actually a hand, like the hand inserted into the rock. And there are four fingers perfectly formed inside the rock. In other words, that you can stick your hand into these four finger places and it fits a human hand, fits my hand perfectly. And interestingly also, she was being pulled. So when her hand went into the rock, it kind of torqued to the side like that, as though you were pulling from this direction. And I've seen that kind of thing. I've been to pilgrimage places before where they say, oh, these two little marks on the rock are an imprint of this great Mahasiddha having practiced there, or there's this footprint in the rock or something like that. And you look at it and you think, yeah, it could be. And so it's kind of inspiring. But about this, there was no doubt, no doubt whatsoever. This hand went into the rock. It torqued that way. And it even, like in my hand, when I open my hand wide, there's my pinky stays out a little bit more than the others. Well, this was the same way. This hand went in like that. The three were fairly close together. The pinky was that way, and it was torqued to the side, and it fit perfectly as though you were grabbing the rock and coming this way. In fact, it was so certain that that's exactly what that was in the rock, and the feeling was so overwhelming that just everybody that was there, when they stuck their hand in the rock and felt how perfectly, the hand was printed in there and had torqued to the side, the feeling was that immediately people would cry. And there was just this immediate welling up of tears or devotion. And the thought that one would have immediately is, what would it take? What kind of love would it take? What kind of devotion would it take for a student to be threatened by being pulled away from their teacher, and the devotion to be so strong that it actually imprinted into the rock like that? What kind of power comes from that devotion, that flesh can penetrate into rock? What kind of love is that? And, you know, I think about that in our lives and our training and, you know, coming back here to America, I see that we're Buddhists and we have the nice little throne, we have the nice little mandala, we have the nice little altar, and we have the nice little students. But I wonder, will we ever know anything like that? Will we ever have that kind of experience of such certainty, such freedom from doubt, such purity in our devotion, such singular absorption in love of our teacher? Will we ever know anything like that? And I think that here in America, and this is something I've been thinking about since I went there, that we are somewhat disabled, handicapped in a certain way. And it's not so much that we ourselves are substandard or anything like that. It's not like that. It's the way that we were trained. And, of course, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Are we trained this way and then, therefore, our karma is created? Or are we trained this way because of our karma and habitual tendency? According to the Buddhist teaching, we would not be having the experience that we're having now if this weren't the karmic pattern or habitual tendency within our mind stream. So what comes first, the chicken or the egg? It's hard to say. But at any rate, what we do know is that here in this country, we are somewhat disabled in our practice. How does that disability come about? Well, first of all, one of the things I've noticed in my years of talking to students and hearing about their life experiences, When I have consultations with students, generally, the first few consultations before they get the lay of the land, the first few times that I talked to them, the student, it's a little bit like psychotherapy. If any of you have ever had psychotherapy, the first few sessions, you might you toss them. They're useless. Basically, it's the patient going in there and doing their little shuck and jive dance, and the psychiatrist kind of rolls their eyes for a few sessions, and then after a while, you get down to some work. But in a consultation, the situation is somewhat similar in that my first meetings with students is always that they want to talk about themselves. They want to tell me how unique and different they are. And that kind of precludes the ability for them to understand that the Buddha has taught every single circumstance, every single condition, and every single result, every single problem, and every single relief from that problem. And so they're really essentially, from the perspective of the Buddha Dharma, from the perspective of the Bodhisattvas, there really is no new or unique situation or individual. And it's not that each one of you are not precious. It's that everything that compiles your problematic situation and your connection with life is a pattern that has been seen before. It's not new. Even with 5 billion people on the planet, we are a conglomeration of conditions that are associated with simply being a sentient being. But my first few consultations with students is always about them divulging to me the deep content of their lives. And it's part of what has to happen between a student and a teacher. It's part of how they get close to each other. So there, we develop an attitude of patience, and we try to get to the point where some real teaching can actually occur. But in my years of doing that, I've heard many different things about students. And one of the things that I hear repeatedly that is very obvious to me is that we are not taught how to think. We are not taught how to think in full equations. We are not taught how to understand the relationship between cause and result. We are not taught how to think something through to the end. We are not taught how to look past a certain window of reaction that each one of us has. In fact, we're taught to be more reactive than we are taught to be thinkers. Even those people that seem very cerebral, you know, very academic, very intellectual, if you really, really listen to the way they think, if you listen to it with good old common sense, the kind of natural intelligence that causes us to actually survive for a while, that kind of common sense, when you listen to a person who, again, has had maybe a great deal of education, you'll find still in all that we really don't know how to think. We're not taught how to think. And furthermore, we are taught a certain kind of survival routine, I guess, or a certain kind of survival mechanism or pattern that may be working against our spiritual development. And that survival kind of situation is that we are taught that, how can I put it? We are taught that there are certain conditions that are absolutely necessary within our lives. We are taught that there are certain events that may happen or certain occurrences in our environment that we should always approach with extreme caution, and we should always deliberate about. There are certain kinds of reactions that we have to anything that is threatening to us that, although it may help us to cope in certain ways, and it may be an excellent coping mechanism. I mean, certainly that kind of thinking will keep us from walking into a moving truck or from going into a really bad neighborhood and getting mugged. If we're smart, if we use that kind of thinking, it can serve us. But on the other hand, that kind of thinking can also keep us from responding in a natural and open and relaxed way. And this is the problem that is characteristic in our society and our culture in this day and age that is so different from the conditions necessary to give the kind of dramatic devotion and love that maybe Mandarava must have felt in order to leave her hand in that rock like that, in order to be so absolutely certain that she would not be pulled away from the teacher, would not be pulled away from the path, would not be pulled away from her spiritual practice. She was so absolutely determined. It was so unthinkable, it was so unacceptable, that even physical conditions as we know them, even the laws of physics, would not bind her to remaining in samsara or remaining in the realm of suffering. She knew what she was about. She knew that she was going through the door of liberation, that this was her chance, and nothing was going to take her away from it. Nothing was going to remove her from that elixir, which is the liberator, from that precious jewel, which is actually the door of liberation, one's teacher, one's path. We, on the other hand, are taught pretty much directly and then also indirectly never to be like that. We are taught never to truly surrender our hearts. We don't do it in love relationships. We don't do it in spiritual relationships. We are taught to keep something aside for ourselves, for safety. It's this kind of don't go there into the scary place message, you know? Don't ever really give your heart. Never allow, always control yourself. Always be in control. Never allow yourself to be so on fire with this passion of devotion that you are completely ignited. Never really completely spread your wings. Never really do that. Keep everything close to your chest. Keep everything controlled. Be sure you do like that. We are taught never to actually spiritually take flight, because to us that would be a fool's mission. We think, you know, we're in a materialistic society and everything has got to be very concrete for us. We don't like abstract thought too much. We like everything to be very concrete. And so we are taught never to really take flight. We don't want to step off that cliff into the abyss. And furthermore, we are taught to trust. What is it? What is the saying? Only half of what you see and nothing of what you hear. Is that the expression? It's kind of like that. So when our parents, when our society taught us that, they thought they were doing us a favor, that we wouldn't be duped, that we wouldn't be fooled. And in some cases, it's useful, because it's useful to have some kind of discrimination when someone just gives you information. You want to develop a kind of discrimination that causes you to maybe see through the filter of their particular conceptualization process. Maybe take it with a grain of salt. Just hear it through the filter of understanding that their thinking may not be so clear. Or even when you read the newspaper, or when you hear something from a politician. Heaven knows that is the right time to use some discrimination, isn't it? That's when you really want to use that discrimination. So when we hear that kind of thing or read from the newspaper something, we have this ability to stand back and go, well, I don't think I'm going to buy that hook, line, and sinker. I think I'm going to wait and see, what's the real story here? What's this all about now? So in some cases, we have been taught something that is very useful to us. Don't take any wooden nickels, you know, that sort of thing. But when it comes to spirituality, how do we discriminate? Because now something that is a coping mechanism that we are taught to keep us safe is actually working against us. You see? We're a little bit like the animals that I was describing. An animal knows that under certain circumstances there is a fear trigger. There is simply a fear trigger, and across the board, the animal will, if they see anything like it, will experience fear. Because they can't discriminate. They can't say, oh, this loud noise is a chainsaw coming at me. This loud noise is a vacuum cleaner, not likely to hurt me. You see what I'm saying? There's no discrimination. Well, human beings aren't so different. We're not so different. We are taught anything that tries to get us to give rise to so much passion must be bad. It must be dangerous. keep both feet on the ground. Make sure that, you know, all your supports are in your life. Make sure that everything is nice and neat and controlled. You don't want any of those messy emotions. You know what they do? They just mess the floor up. You know, they just mess up your life. There's no neat compartments they can be put into. And you know how it is. Sometimes you want your ice cream when you want your ice cream. And so that means when you want to feel great passion, you're going to feel it low, let's say from 10 o'clock. Let's say maybe you're going to practice from 10 to 12. So from 10 o'clock in the morning till 12 o'clock noon, you're going to feel some real passion. Now you have to feel some real passion. But at 12:01, by golly, you better be able to put that stuff away, because the rest of your life is not a place where it's safe to be penetrated by love. See, but we can't do that. We can't do that. We are not able to turn it on and off like that. Either we take flight or we don't. Either we learn to love in this extraordinary way or we don't. It's very, very difficult to discriminate. So what am I saying? Am I saying just throw caution to the wind, never think straight again, you know, just like run around being passionate or something? No, of course I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. But I am pointing out that we do have a certain disability that maybe we want to look after. We want to look into and see if there isn't some way that we can make the way straight, that we can open the doors, that we can allow a fire to burn within us that hasn't burnt before. The flip side of this, the side that's really strange, is that those of us who learn to control and use our feelings and use our passions, that's one thing. That's another thing that we see in our society, is that people use their passions to manipulate others, or they use their passions in a creative way to make a dynamic energy. And some people form that into art or music, and other people form it into a passion for one's vocation or something like that, a passion for one's children or one's loved ones, that sort of thing. Yet even there, when you are taking something that is a very natural thing, it's like the difference between if you could find, let's say, a spring where this marvelous, purified, extraordinary, oxidized, mineralized, super nutritious, yum-yum water comes out, and you can drink it directly from the source, that would be very, very nourishing. But if you were to take that same water and bottle it in one of those little plastic jugs that everybody, myself included, carries around, it's not quite the same thing. It's not the same living, breathing experience. And see, that's what we try to do with our passions, because we've taught to be afraid of them. And then we wonder why it is that our spiritual life leaves us cold. And interestingly, those among us who think the most clearly, who have a plan, who always stick to their plan, those people who are very much thinkers, who think all the way, you know, about everything, every single angle of every single thing that you could possibly imagine, who intellectualize everything, who put everything in tight, neat little boxes. Oftentimes, those people throughout their lives come to a place where, if they're honest, they find that they are running dry and that they are extremely hungry for something. Extremely hungry. But they don't want to think about what it might be, because we're still afraid of this passion, you see. And so we run around trying to find other outlets for it. Maybe I can develop a passion for some particular thing. Maybe art, maybe animals, maybe something like that. So each one of us tries to find relief from this very dry, kind of removed experience of life that we are having. And still in all, we try to approach spirituality, and with spirituality we have the same kind of idea. You know, we'll be spiritual from whatever time we allow for practice. Say in the beginning we only allow 20 minutes of practice a day, which is common. In the beginning people do that. So I'm going to have my experience, and it's going to be locked into this 20-minute bite. And then later on, maybe it's an hour, maybe it's 2 hours after that. Maybe it varies, but we have this experience where everything is nice and neat, and we keep it all in little pigeonholes, and there is no natural birthing. There is no giving rise to something that sustains one throughout the course of one life, that warms one, that keeps one juicy. You know? I don't know how else to explain it besides saying juicy. So, some of what we experience then, some of what we have been taught, is useful, and it causes us to remain safe. It causes us to think how to negotiate our way through a practical material world, but we also are kind of dying inside, you know? And then my experience has been people will come to the path and they've got their whole life set up in little pigeonholes. And then after you talk to them for a few times, after a while you get that they are so hungry, that they really are so hungry they can hardly articulate their hunger. In fact, if you talk to them about their hunger and try to touch the soft button in them so that they'll come out a little bit and talk to you about it and feel safe doing that, oh, they can hardly think about it. They run emotionally, conversationally, intellectually. We run from knowing how hungry we are for that water of life, that juiciness, that wellspring of passion and fire to come forth from within oneself. But for those of us who have somehow given rise, and spiritually it can take many different forms, to some sort of extraordinary living faith in the three precious jewels, or in the door, you know, in the potential and possibility and magnitude of what liberation would be like, or to give rise in faith to one's guru in the form of devotion, to have that kind of extraordinary devotion, or to give rise to this phenomenal flower or flame, I should say, of compassion, to where compassion is this burning force throughout your life, that you can't look at anything the way you used to. You can't look about, you know, how much can I have and what can I do to make me happy. But instead, your life becomes like, sort of like Mother Teresa. I think about Mother Teresa as being a great bodhisattva who is on fire, you know. She has this flame of love inside of her. And so this flame of love is this natural passion that is a juicifier and a sustainer and a lifter and a nourisher and a warm hearth inside one's mind and one's heart. For those people who have managed somehow to give birth to something like that, it is they are a different kind of person. They are a completely different kind of person. They do not have the same level of neuroses as the first kind of person. They are sustained by something that is kind of like a yes inside, or a life, a thing that is of life rather than anti-life. A natural passion. And so for a person like that, there is a greater sense of joy, a greater sense of freedom, a greater sense of color, taste, something. And those are also the kind of people that everyone else follows around. Have you ever noticed that? A person that's on fire, that has love, that has faith, that has devotion, that has something inside of them that's a, you can feel it, it's a living thing. Those are the kind of people that other people are fascinated with. Afraid of sometimes, but also fascinated with. And they follow people like that around. And it's that kind of charisma that causes leaders to be leaders. There's a fire there, and everybody wants to be warm. Everybody wants to be warm. But again, we are trained in such a way that our quest for safety, our quest for keeping everything in a nice, neat little control place, everything in its place and a place for everything. And boy, the best thing to do is keep it in something that has drawers so you can close them. Because that's the neatest of all. And so we feel that if we live like that, there's no risk. Is it true? Oh, no. Oh, no, no. Life has a way of contriving to let us know that even if we are marvelous at control, phenomenal at keeping things neat, unbelievable at sorting things out and keeping them all in their proper piles, just being on top of all of that kind of compulsion and fixation, life will find a way to teach you that that's like nothing. That is so hopeless, and we are so helpless when we put ourselves in that very fragile place. Life will show us that in the same way that a good wind will come by and blow away a pile of leaves that we've carefully stacked up in the fall, if you remember that experience. It's like that with our lives, too, when we find that, in fact, we are not safe. And, in fact, if all of our safety got put into making ourselves feel like we have control over everything, if that's where our safety comes from, that kind of person will feel the least safe of all. But the person who has given rise to some kind of fire or passion, even if it's a little messy, even if it can burn stuff up, even if it can cause you to make big, dramatic, beautiful, splashy decisions that your neighbors aren't making, still in all, you have a fire. And that fire is a force. You have love. And that love is strong, that compassion, that love, that bodhicitta, that giving rise to the natural, spontaneous element of your nature that is consistent with your own enlightened potential. To give rise to that, actually, that is the greatest, strongest rock that there is in samsara. You can depend on that. And obviously, from the story about Mandarava, it's even stronger than rock. It's stronger than anything on the face of this earth. To be truly alive, to know for certain that there is nothing in your heart and in your mind more precious than liberation, than achieving realization, than giving rise to the bodhicitta, than entering into the door of liberation. If that becomes for you the stable force, the light of your life, the great passion, well, that cannot be destroyed in the world because it isn't of the world. You know, it's said in every single great religion that makes any sense at all that, and what is it, Christianity says something like, do not lay aside your treasures where they can be eaten by, chewed by moths or rusted or something like that. I'm sorry. Wrong religion for me, can't quote it. But the idea is pretty much across the board in all the world's great religions, that the treasures of the world do not sustain you. The things that you can control and have and plan and modulate and incorporate are not the things that will keep you safe. In fact, if that's what you depend on, you have nothing. And so when I was at that cave, I was thinking about Mandarava, and I was thinking, well, that must have been a real traumatic day when her father, the king, came and tried to take her away from Guru Rinpoche, and she was screaming. The tale is that she was just screaming and, you know, wailing, and she grabbed that rock and stuck her fingers right into it. You can imagine that must have been a pretty traumatic day. That must have been a tough day. I mean, most of us would just head for the Prozac after a day like that. You know? maybe you give that old bionic arm a little workout, you know. And that would be a bad day. Happy hour would be a happy thing after that. But, and that's how we think about something like that. That depth of love, that depth of passion is just too darn scary. We're scared of that. We like everything neat. I mean, you know, we spent all our lives getting to where we could buy a house in Potomac. Don't mess it up. You know, it's kind of like that. So, it feels like in that kind of condition, we shouldn't put ourselves in danger. We should not. That's too messy. Just don't do that. And yet, It seems to me that what really happened there that day was that she could not be moved. Now, anything you can plan with your mind, anything you can organize with your thinking, anything you can put in a box can be moved. Anything that you cling to on that ordinary level can work against you. It is not a rock to cling to. But here was this practitioner who experienced the thing she would not allow to happen due to the force of her devotion, and she was able to overcome that. She was able to prevent being separated from the path, being separated from the light of her life, from the love that was her passion. It was impossible to separate her from her guru, from her path, from the face of liberation, which is what we are taught we should understand our guru represents to us, the very face of our own liberation. And so that day, that scary day, that messy day, that day when nothing happened the way it was supposed to, nothing that was planned for that day, I guess, happened. But instead, on that day, she proved that there was no force on the face of this earth that could tear her away from the sustenance, the meat, the fulfillment, the light of her life. Do you think that after a day like that, she really felt disempowered? Do you think that she felt too messy? Do you think she wished that she, did not have that experience? My feeling is that probably what happened after that was that she knew on a deeper level than ever before that there is no force in this world stronger than devotion, than compassion, than love. One of the things I knew about her by sitting in that cave that I could feel from the depth of my being, that most of her prayers were about benefiting sentient beings. I could feel the tears that she had cried. I could feel her level of compassion. I could feel that she would sit there and contemplate on the horrible condition that sentient beings experience, like the oysters that I was talking about, how helpless they are. Like human beings who struggle with doubt and who are unable to ever, ever truly give their heart. And so they are unable to break the chain of samsara. And in that cave, she spent a lot of time crying for the condition of sentient beings, and most of her time was spent praying that the suffering of sentient beings would be ended. So her commitment was to stay in that prayer, to practice in that cave rather, to practice with her teacher. And her life was about devotion and bodhicitta. And that day she was able to prove that there isn't even a rock in this world that could keep her away from that. So ultimately, what tends to be the greatest, strongest, most liberating, most dependable force? Ultimately, in this case, it wasn't even the rock. It was the love. And in our lives, is it the things that we try to take safety in that are material and impermanent? Or is it the fire that we carry over from life to life? Because it's true, I have been recognized as an incarnation of Mandarava. And I'll tell you that although I guess I don't look like she used to look, I guess I'm not a princess anymore. Lord knows they don't have them in Brooklyn. And I guess I don't have my very own cave. I guess things are pretty different now. Didn't used to have a car, now I do. So a lot of things are different. But there's one thing that gets carried over from lifetime to lifetime, and that tells me how strong it is. In this lifetime, I really don't even care if you call me a Buddhist or not. I don't care about the B word or any religious doctrine other than that of devotion and bodhicitta, faith and love. And so that has carried over from lifetime to lifetime. It even survives death. And that's all I know. That's the only truth that I know. I don't know anything else. People that know me know that I can hardly find my way across town. But I do know about devotion, and I do know about love. And so I know how to live my life according to those principles as well. So that thing even survives the great ending of death, that we've been taught nothing survives. And so when our parents taught us to guard ourselves and keep ourselves strong and make ourselves safe, you have to understand that our parents were measuring life with the same limited tools that their parents had before them, that they didn't understand any better, that our parents, although I'm sure they were trying to prepare us for life kindly so, still, they only knew this tiny little piece of something that began since time out of mind and continues until samsara is exhausted, until all the causes for samsara are exhausted. Our reality, all of the cause and effect situations that have brought us to this present time, began in a time that we can't even mark. It's so long ago. Time out of mind. We have lived uncountable lives, and we will remain in samsara until we exit samsara due to the force of our practice. And so our parents didn't know that. They didn't. When they received the child, that child became real to them the moment it was in the stomach, you know, in the uterus, or for the woman, or when it was born, for the parents together as a unit. That's when the child became real. That was when our parents knew us. And they know us only as long as they know us, and they try to give us teachings accordingly. And basically, they're trying to teach us about an elephant by looking at an elephant through a tiny little peephole where you can only see one little piece of the elephant. You've heard that story, haven't you? You know, one person looking at the tail of the elephant through a peephole will think it's a snake. Another one looking at the trunk of the elephant through a peephole will think it's a branch. You know, each person looking at their little piece of the elephant will think it's something different. But the interesting thing about us is that we will be sure that it's a snake or a tree trunk or whatever part we're looking at. And that's how our parents taught us. And although they were kind in their intention, did they really teach us what matters? No. Did they really teach us how to stay safe? No, they didn't. They wanted to, they meant to, but they didn't know. That the very thing that keeps us safe may be the messiest, biggest, noisiest, squishiest, hottest, uncontrollable force. The most unmanageable force that we are capable of. The passion of love, the passion of devotion, the passion of bodhicitta. But we were told, now be careful, don't give your heart, don't go too far, don't do that, you know it gets messy. That's what we were taught. But the Buddha teaches us that in order to give rise to extraordinary results, we have to use extraordinary methods, extraordinary means. So I've spent the last, how many years have I been teaching? What, 15, something like that? I've spent the last 15 years trying to communicate, leaving the shore, in a way, and putting yourself out to sea. Not in an unthinking way or an unintelligent way, but being willing to see the safety disappear a little bit, the safety that we were taught was safe, and live an extraordinary life. And I've been teaching for 15 years, and I think I've taught this 150 million different ways. But it is giving rise to the bodhicitta. It is living a life empowered by compassion and love. It is having that great faith and that devotion that causes you to engage in extraordinary methods that will ultimately cause us to experience the safety of exiting samsara with all of its causes and conditions, all of its conditions and responses, all of its causes and effects. Because it is in samsara where karma is constantly ripening, where we didn't know how to create only virtuous and pure karma, that we are not safe. And hanging out here where we were taught to hang out is not the thing to do. So now we have to, as we enter into the path, develop a sense of extraordinary discrimination. The fear will come up. Students come to me all the time, they'll say, I'm just so confused, I can't think all this through. My answer to that is, I'm sorry, forgive the French, bullshit. Because what's really happening there is we are delaying something powerful. Delaying commitment. Delaying what you can do to make yourself strong. Our programming has taught us not to be strong, to be invisible, to plan, to put things in boxes, to keep everything neat, to conceptualize and to live according to those conceptions. And we were never taught to risk in order to give rise to great passion. We were never taught to be affected by the suffering of the world sufficiently enough where we can love. All we know how to do is to protect ourselves. But there's so much more. If you could only understand that that force of love is unconquerable once we actually give rise to it. Nothing can resist it. And no matter what we see in front of our eyes, it will continue to grow like a great blessing and will appear life after life after life. It is the only thing that we can take with us. None of the things we were told to feel safe with can be taken with us. But that love can, the habit of love, the habit of devotion, the habit of that kind of passion, that can be brought from life to life. So I suggest that you get another opinion, a second opinion. You know, you got one from your mom, you got one from your dad, got one from your parents. Now you need a second opinion. And so I'm giving it to you. I think that you ought to reevaluate what actually keeps you safe. I think you ought to reevaluate what it takes to be happy. It isn't protecting yourself. It's loving. It isn't standing outside the experience of the holy and the mystical, the experience of the outrageously colorful, beautiful, deep, profound, moving experience of spirituality. To stand outside of that does not keep you safe. It keeps you dry. It keeps you impotent. It keeps you quiet. But it doesn't keep you safe. So now as we enter onto the path, and those of us who are practicing the path for some time, maybe it's time to reassess and maybe it's time to take a new view. Even those of us that have been practicing for a long time, how much, you know, we have it all compartmentalized. You know how it is. This much for the three precious jewels, this much for my path, and this much for me, as though there were a difference. And so long as there is a difference, in your mind, there always will be. So long as you see yourself precious, separate rather from what is precious, well, you always will be. And for those of us who are just starting on the path, the first thing to do before you call yourself a Buddhist or get one of these gizmos, you know, or learn how to do some mantra or start looking like us, you know, we all wear shawls and everything, you know, before you start doing any of that, the thing to do is to develop a good heart, a really open, loving, risking heart, one with a big flame, one that burns everything up, including all your ideas, especially those. That's the best kind of heart to have, messy. So messy that it splashes over and fills the world. So that's what it takes to start out. You have to ask yourself, are you ready? If you are, let's do it. If not, get ready. Because it's the only treasure that you have that will sustain you. And it is part of you. It is not something that you have to build. You don't have to compose it. You don't have to get one. You don't have to grow one. It is your nature. You are the very bodhicitta. You are that. And as we awaken to our Buddha nature, that's what we discover, that that flame is the truth of us. And all the control and all the separation and all the whatever that thing is that we do when we arrest ourselves, that is the lie. So I suggest that you think about these things and think about your training, think what you were taught, and think how it reflects in every area of your life, from your ordinary relationships to your relationship with spirituality. And see how constipated we are. And see what you can do about incubating something precious inside of you. You go through whatever kind of gestation you need. Be pregnant with love. And then give birth when you're ready. So thank you very much for coming today. I really appreciate seeing you again. And as I continue to teach, I will draw on the experiences that we had in our pilgrimage. And I will use them because they were extraordinary. And I would like to bring back here some of the wealth of the things that we see in such an ancient culture as the Indian culture, which is the root of Buddhism, actually in India rather than in Tibet. That's where the Buddha began. And so I would like to bring back to you some of the flavor of that. I mean, when you go to a place like India, as an American, you think, oh my gosh, the bathrooms, they are so weird. And then you think about the cleanliness problem and the fact that you will definitely get the trots at some point while you're there. And all of these different American assessments of your situation go on. And some of them are true, some of them are not. But one thing I can tell you is that while you're there, you will see the difference between a very old, spiritually based culture and a very new, material based culture. And the differences are phenomenal. So I'd like to be able to bring some of that here through the stories that I'll be telling you in the time to come. So anyway, thank you very much for coming today. I really appreciate your presence, and I hope that you enjoy the rest of the day. And we'll see you next time.
This podcast has been a production of Kunzang Payul Choling. For more teachings, meditations, and resources, you can visit our online virtual temple at tara.org. That's tara.org.